On this week's 51%, we meet a veteran who suffered sexual violence and now advocates for ending military sexual trauma.
So a lot of sexual violence still happens in the military, and we were actually able to help a lot of women achieve justice in a way that they would have been retaliated on their own had they not had the movement.
And writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares an essay on synagogue doors and letting in the light. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. Resident of New York's Hudson Valley, who is an advocate for policy reform around military sexual trauma, says new legislation in New York concerning veterans is trailblazing. Her work and her story helped inspire the legislation that Governor Andrew Cuomo signed on Veterans Day. Democrat Dede Barrett sponsored the bill in the Assembly, a measure she says is a first in the nation.
It makes people who received bad papers because of bad military policies eligible to get their honor restored and their benefits under New York state law restored.
The Restoration of Honor Act extends the eligibility for state benefits to veterans who have received a less than honorable discharge because of unfair or discriminatory discharge policies, which include for traumatic brain injury, post-traumatic stress disorder, and military sexual trauma, as well as veterans who received a discharge for their sexual orientation or gender identity under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Barrett, who chairs the Assembly Committee on Veterans Affairs, says there was some pushback when she first started working on the bill, but not from the legislature.
Initially, it required some conversations with some of the old guard, military organizations, or, certain individuals. But I think everybody, whatever battle and whatever war you fought in, knows people who are struggling with PTSD. I think people are increasingly aware of military sexual trauma and how it's impacted women and men, and how challenging that is if, for example, you're, called into a meeting with somebody who was your attacker, and you have to deal with that, and people handle things in different ways.
U.S. Marine Corps veteran Janelle Mendez is founder of the Military Sexual Assault Movement.
I am ecstatic to hear that that change has finally been implemented. For me personally, it's been a really long journey. I am a veteran and survivor of military sexual trauma. For anyone who doesn't really have a knowledge base on that, basically when service members come forward to report sexual violence, 62% have reported retaliation. So I am one of the veterans who experienced that. I am part of the majority, but a lot of people in the general public don't know that that happens. And the way in which retaliation generally happens is with retaliatory discharges. So meaning that you'll come forward and you'll report, a rape or a sexual assault that occurs. And when you do, your chain of command will then somehow find a reason in the UCMJ to write some kind of charge up on you to basically discharge you adversely. So a lot of OTHs, they're very common amongst the military sexual trauma community. So going through that storyline and that struggle, in my case, I didn't know that I would be reporting sexual violence, and then all of a sudden I would be coming out homeless, not even knowing I was getting discharged. And then I go to apply for benefits and I found that I don't qualify. So in my case, it took me 2 years to get out of homelessness. And it wasn't until I got a job in finance and when I started working at a bank where I even started making enough money to pull myself out of homelessness. And it took 2 years to do that. And at the same time, I was dealing with so much trauma from what had happened. So I was going through PTSD, which I did not know I had at the time, and I didn't even know you can get PTSD from sexual violence. And I started to get involved in substance abuse. So I had a really, really hard time when I got out, and I just felt like no one was able to help me, and I felt like I was ignored by everybody that I was going to for help. So, this legislation getting changed to me is a huge marker in saying, as a community, we're taking a stand and we're saying that enough is enough and that we're going to protect those who come next. So, you know, other people who are dealing with these struggles and these adversities can now live meaningful lives after their trauma, and they don't have to feel like they're alone or they're suffering, because that leads to suicidal idealization. And we already know that the veteran community has the highest rates of suicide. So I think this is literally groundbreaking legislation that's changing the entire course of the future and how we look at taking care of veterans and living up to those commitments that we say as a nation that we live for.
Was the sexual violence perpetrated against you repeatedly, or was this a one-off one person?
I went through a series of sexual violence, and I reported two incidents that ultimately led to my discharge. But yeah, it's actually really common in the military sexual trauma community that sexual violence does happen. And the robust legislation, the reason Dee Dee Barrett and I had that conversation was because I had a conversation with her about how different categories of veterans get doubly disenfranchised. And what we spoke about was that you could have mental illness and you're reacting out of the mental illness because you don't know that you have it, or you're dealing with other forms of sexual violence earlier on, so you're developing PTSD and now you're dealing with this mental illness plus the trauma, and then you're getting constantly retaliated against versus getting the services that you need. And then what had happened in that conversation was I had spoke to her because I had one of the women in my movement is part of the LGBTQIA community. And when I heard her story about what she went through in service, I started to realize how there was an intersection of different classes of veterans being disenfranchised. So it was important to me that the No Bad Paper Bill series was an inclusive bill that would target all of the different groups that were being disenfranchised to be able to lift them up together. Because like what would happen is there was a time in the military that if you were considered homosexual, you would get an other than honorable discharge, right? Like kind of like what's going on with the transgender ban or what was happening with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So I felt that, you know, people for being who they are authentically should not be getting retaliated against for that. Or for instance, someone, you know, is in the LGBTQIA community, they do go through sexual violence. They report the sexual violence, and now someone in their chain of command knows that they're homosexual or knows that they're transgender and then uses that as a way to get them discharged. So what happened was as the movement was growing, I started learning about all of these different ways that veterans were being retaliated against. And it was, you know, due to their mental illness or due to the fact that they were reporting or due to the fact that they were part of the LGBTQIA community. And I didn't want to be like every other state that was piecemealing whatever they could to put something together. I wanted to use this as an opportunity to make a statement. And I felt that making a broad statement of, hey, let's put something really robust together that's really going to impact change for a large group of veterans that are disenfranchised, that was something to me that was important to do. So when I met with Dee Dee, her value system aligned really well with mine. And when we were talking about how do we progress these disenfranchised populations, we were talking about how to structure these bills. And, you know, we began working on them over the course of a couple months. And, you know, we were able to make magic happen.
Yeah, and have the governor sign, because that is the key, right, to enacting legislation.
So it was definitely easier to get, you know, the bills passed in both houses. I mean, and it took lobbying efforts, right? Like, that's politics 101. But, yeah, we wrote some letters to the governor, and, you know, we had obviously everyone in the movement sign on to that. We did some petitions and stuff. And then, you know, Dee Dee was really a key player in making everything happen that happened. So, like, I'm incredibly thankful for her and, you know, not only for helping me and, you know, us being able to work together to make history, but at the same time, she is the first female veterans chair of the New York State Assembly. So, like, that's groundbreaking in and of itself. And I think this legislation speaks to the volumes of what happens when women move into power.
When did you get discharged?
I got discharged in 2008.
Okay. So when did you form Military Sexual Trauma Movement? Because in talking about all the other issues you were grappling with, mm-hmm. substance abuse, homelessness, all of that, mm-hmm. I mean, that doesn't resolve overnight. I mean, that, you know, so when did you form the movement and when did you kind of get it together, as it were, mm-hmm. and you know, get a home, get a job, et cetera?
So So yeah, it took, so I got into finance when I got out, and honestly, it was, I was desperate for a job and I needed an opportunity. So I got into finance and, you know, I started building my career then, and I was doing excellent. Like, I just kept getting promoted rapidly. So, you know, 2 years from my discharge is when I was able to purchase a home. It had nothing in it. Like, I didn't have anything. I was so broke, but I knew that I needed a home, like, because I knew I was going to stay dealing with substance abuse issues if I, like, did not basically get off the street. And, you know, I was doing a lot of things to survive, that I just was doing anything to survive. So finance was really giving me the stability I needed to grow. And as I built my career over the years in finance, and I learned, you know, just how finance in general works, I was able to start empowering myself. So what actually happened was, about a year and a half ago, I went through a miscarriage. And when I went through the miscarriage, when I was in the hospital, I was halfway through my pregnancy, and I went through severe flashbacks of when I got raped in the military. And the flashbacks were so intense. Like, I went to the VA and I'm like, look, I'm having problems with this. This is what's going on. And then I was like, I've had flashbacks before, but this is worse. Like, this is more severe. And I could not function. So I was out of work for a couple months. And when I spoke to the VA about it, then I found out that this is common, that this happens pretty often. And when I started going through a more advanced treatment program than what I was in, and I started really educating myself, I started also talking about it in, like, the female Marine communities online. And it was basically a huge me too, me too, me too. And I was like, wow, all of you are dealing with this struggle. None of us talk about it. We're scared to have these conversations, but this is the real reality of what female veterans go through. So at that point, I started, you know, formulating a group of women together. And then from there, it evolved into the movement. And then at that point, I'm like, okay, I have the knowledge, the skills to do this. I'm going to go forward with, in, you know, speaking out about this, like, publicly. So I started speaking out about it, and then the movement just moved and just flourished in and of itself. So it's almost been 2 years.
How helpful has it been for you and for other women to have this community of women to kind of have a platform and to be there for one another, not only before you founded the movement, but now that you have the movement? In what direction do you see it going? How is it different, maybe, than — it's pretty new. I mean, 2 years is not a long time, but where do you see it going, and how has it changed over the past couple of years?
Well, there's a lot of different things. Like, the direction it's going in, like, did I think it was going to go in that direction? Absolutely not. But there's a lot of different aspects that happen, but I think all in all, the community feels more empowered. I think it was a lot of people who were feeling like, yes, we're surviving, but barely. And, you know, they don't know what to do to create solutions. I think that's kind of where everyone was at. But a lot of stories, we were able, in a lot of different local papers throughout the country and in various states, we were able to have survivors tell their stories. And we also, a lot of sexual violence still happens in the military, and we were actually able to help a lot of women achieve justice. In a way that they would have been retaliated on their own had they not had the movement. So we were able to bring a lot of those injustices to the public eye, where the military wasn't necessarily doing the right thing. So I would say definitely a place of empowerment, and I also think the movement's a huge sign of hope. And I think that's probably the most critical aspect, is that, you know, you can go through suffering and pain and struggle, but when you're an individual, there's only so much you can do. But when you create community and communities come together and everyone empowers each other, it becomes a healing process. And I think it's through the healing process which change happens.
You're still in finance?
I work in finance, but only for a couple more weeks. I definitely want to focus on my mental health, my overall physical health. But also, I'm going to be working on the movement. I think, you know, I found my passion, and I found something that I feel is needed. So, and I feel like the impact is so much stronger than what I can do in finance.
Just circling back to the assembly member's bill, I wanted to know, since you were discharged a while ago, as you said, you got out in 2008, and this is taking effect now, how will this impact you? Because you obviously did a lot on your own in terms of seeking help and getting better, and I don't know what services you accessed, but can you now go back and access services that you couldn't before? I mean, how will you be taking advantage of this bill, if any, outside of an advocacy role?
Yeah, so for myself, basically what I actually just did is I put for my own discharge paperwork through New York State for a discharge upgrade. So basically I'm going to wait on that certificate to come in and then send that to the federal government to have them overturn my discharge. So like, because they could do that on the legal aspect. So that's something that I'm working on. And then in terms of the VA system, I actually do have my benefits back and I had to go through a special process for that. That actually does, it takes a while. So I had to go through a process to essentially prove that I went through sexual violence and that I'm entitled to benefits and that my discharge was directly correlated to that. So I won that case at the VA system. But I am intending to finish out my upgrade through New York State. And hopefully, once that also gets finished, I'll be able to access those benefits. Because right. there's a lot of benefits, from vocational benefits to schooling benefits, housing and medical benefits, that the bill encompasses, that are given through New York State. So all of those different benefits, too, I'm definitely, once everything is processed out, you know, I'm going to participate in that.
So it sounds like there's more benefits you'd be able to access by virtue of this legislation. And had this legislation been in place when you were discharged, you wouldn't have had to go through as many hoops as you're going through or have gone through. Is that correct?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Are you
yeah.
kidding me? At that point, yeah. I would have been able to access housing. Like not for anything, but for you to get raped, and then in my case, they retaliated against me, and I got thrown in the brig. And then I had to fight a case. It got dismissed. Then I find out I'm getting discharged, and then I come out and I find out I'm homeless. So it's like to go through that level of trauma. At that point, I was having suicidal ideation. Like I overdosed and I almost killed myself. So like the thing is, going through those experiences, had I had the help when I got out, I would have been able to go into treatment, and then from there I would have secured housing, and my PTSD would probably not be as severe as it is because I'm diagnosed with complex post-traumatic stress disorder. So I have like the most severe type of PTSD.
Yeah.
And then with all the other hardships that I was dealing with, it's like trauma after trauma after trauma. So it's like, you know, your brain, and at my age, right? I enlisted at 16 and I ended up in boot camp at age 17. And I was just 19, I think, when I was getting out. So like my brain was still forming and developing. So, you know, that's a critical point that if something like that happens to someone who's essentially still has the mind of a child and their brain is still developing, they need support. Like you can't just throw someone out in the street and be like, well, you reported sexual violence. Now you got to figure it out. Now you have to figure everything else out. Like your brain's going to get damaged over time. So it's one of those things that, you know, if I could protect, you know, other people that are coming after me and, you know, they can have, okay, you went through something. It was bad. That trauma hurts, but you're going to be able to return home to New York. You're going to be able to get the services that you need, you know, and you're going to be able to thrive. I think that is the most critical statement that anyone could really make. And I also think that's what justice is in and of itself. And I think that's what opportunity is. And I think that's what the government should be doing.
That was Janelle Mendez, founder of the Military Sexual Assault Movement.
The Song Sparrow, a humble little bird with a big role in history. This is Bird Note. Few backyard birds in North America are more widespread than the song sparrow, but it was study of this seemingly unremarkable bird that helped shape modern ornithology and made the reputation of a pioneer of American bird study. In 1928, Margaret Morse Nice began carefully observing song sparrows near Columbus, Ohio, where she lived. For 8 years, Nice banded and made detailed accounts of the birds' lives and behavior. Her observations led her to create probably the most in-depth natural history of any North American animal at that time. The legacy of Margaret Morse Nice's work lies in her pioneering approach to the study of animal behavior. She helped shift the focus away from collection, description, and distribution. The new thinking put an emphasis on bird behavior and painstaking observation of living birds in the wild. Today, one of the most prestigious honors one can achieve in ornithology is the Margaret Morse Nice Medal. And it all started with that little brown bird with the melodious song. Today's show, brought to you by the Bobolink Foundation.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
Frank and Ethel Gumm were vaudevillians. Frank had met Ethel when she was playing piano behind silent films at a theater in Superior, Wisconsin. They married, and by March 1914, had moved across the state line to Grand Rapids, Minnesota, so Frank could manage the new Grand Theater, where on weekends, Frank and Ethel dusted off their musical act for local audiences. The couple had three daughters, Mary, Dorothy, and Frances, the last born in 1922. The older sisters joined the family act, but Frances, much younger, didn't make her first stage appearance until December 26, 1924. Within 2 years, the Gumm family relocated to California, where in 1934, little sister Frances Gumm changed her name to Judy Garland.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
And now writer Dr. Jerry Byrne shares her take on Hanukkah lights.
As we are coming into this year's holiday season, I've been thinking a lot about something that happened last year at a holiday storytelling gig. We were invited to tell Hanukkah stories at a Hudson Valley synagogue. We hadn't been there for a couple of years and were delighted to return for the 2018 celebration. I was really excited. I'm not actively part of a Jewish community, and I miss my tribe. It's an absence that's a little like a vitamin deficiency and a lot like a bagel shortage. Anyway, we drove into Kingston the night of the Hanukkah gig and arrived at Temple Emmanuel. Barry grabbed the harp and drum and left the car, while I organized, misplaced, grabbed, dropped, repacked, dropped again, and finally gathered my bags and baskets of stuff. I got to the synagogue doors long after Barry got inside. I pulled on the handle. Then I pushed. I couldn't open the door. I knew people were there. I saw Barry adjusting his yarmulke through a window. His bald spot offers little grip. All the lights were on, but I still couldn't get in. Puzzled, I looked around, and then I saw a sign. It said that the doors were locked, and that I should ring the buzzer if the security guard wasn't standing right there. My heart hiccuped. To me, the phrases houses of worship and locked doors don't belong in the same sentence. They are supposed to be havens or sanctuaries with figurative and sometimes literal open doors. Since Temple Emmanuel's doors were never locked for this event in the past, standing in front of that locked door broke my hiccuping heart. There was good reason for this. Pittsburgh. The increase in anti-Semitic hate speech and crimes. I totally got it intellectually, but on a physical and spiritual level, I was shaken. In the past, I pushed open those unlocked glass doors, a welcomed stranger. But on that night, I couldn't open them. Now the only way into this space of peaceful contemplation was to step over a threshold of fear, of hate, of division. The literalness of the metaphor was just too much. I rang the buzzer, and a security guard let me in. He told me that a guard is now stationed at the synagogue every hour that it's open. It's what we've come to, sadly. As our country has moved forward, it has taken many steps back. Like so many other people, I was absolutely devastated by the violence at the Pittsburgh synagogue, not to mention every other hate crime. And standing outside those locked doors in Kingston, I felt every feeling I feel whenever senseless violence occurs. My soul filled with sadness, anger, pain, and darkness. But then I entered the sanctuary. The rich, red-toned, wood-paneled walls were warm. People of all ages milled about. Small children skipped up and down the pews. Everyone was smiling. On a long table behind the pews were 25 Hanukkah menorahs of different shapes and sizes, where colorful candles stood straight and tall, eager to be lit. The cantor was bustling about, too, tuning his guitar and setting up his music stand in preparation for the community candlelighting ritual. As people gathered around the long table, the warmth of this community cheered me. The rabbi, the most joyful one I've ever met, well, she greeted me with a hug. The connection with others, the shared rituals, the singing, everything that happened that evening helped cleanse me of gloom. People gather together despite and because of the toxic division that has been sown in this nation. As I sat that night in the synagogue, ironically, I felt a little bit like Charlie Brown when he finally understood what Christmas is all about. I felt the spirit of Hanukkah that night. Yes, it commemorates the miracle of sacred candles burning for 8 days without sufficient oil, but I was mostly feeling the other aspect of Hanukkah, the celebration of triumph when people rise up against tyranny. As I plucked my harp and sang with everyone, I felt newly confident that it is possible to triumph in dark times, that people from all backgrounds can rise up against the tyranny of hatred. As I watched the twinkling Hanukkah menorahs, I realized that if more and more of us choose to stand together, straight and tall like glowing candles, the more likely it is that we can chase away darkness with light.
Dr. Jerry Burns is a storyteller, writer, and educator living in New York's Hudson Valley. You can find her at storycrafters.com. Burns also is an adjunct professor in the Department of Communication at the State University of New York at New Paltz. That's our show for this week. Thanks to Tina Rennick for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1586.